Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here. Still battling with this cold, however, in great spirits, just a little congested. Got over the hacking cough and all that other stuff that goes with the flu or whatever this bug is that's going around. Feeling much better today. Just a little low on energy, but other than that, high in spirits. And, you know, maybe I should just drink some hot spirits to help overcome this cold. That's the old-fashioned remedy. So, you know, a hot toddy, right? A hot toddy in the middle of a cold winter. But here we are again, and this is Yahweh's Covenant People, broadcasting on Eurofolk Radio as well as Talk Shoe. And tonight we're going to be doing part two of the Parthians. Who were the Parthians? And I just pasted in the chat room a link for tonight's show. And I'm just going to, rather than, you know, it's going to be difficult to read it, although it's very short in this case. It's www.keithhunt.com/parth2.html. So, or if you want to just, if you can't pick up the link in the chat box there, just go to keithhunt.com. And Parthian Empire was Israelite. This is part two, so just search for part two. And we're going to continue from last week's theme, which the previous section on this really good website here. Of course, the problem with it is that they falsely attribute Israelite ancestry to the Jewish people, of course, which is a major error. But you have to read between the lines to figure out what's really going on here, and I'll do my best to clarify. So welcome to everybody in the chat room. Good to see you here. And we're really looking forward to a strong 2016. Eurofolk Radio has begun to reach people by the thousands, no longer by the hundreds, but now by the thousands. And hopefully by the end of this year, it'll be by the hundreds of thousands. And we're not going to run commercials, although our various presenters, if they have a product they want to recommend, they could do that. But we're not going to be selling anything like that on Eurofolk Radio. We may sell our own goods, our own episodes and music and things like that. But we won't be selling any outside stuff. We won't be taking advertisers, put it that way, as Republic Broadcasting does and GCN and all these other ones. Whenever you do that, you know, whenever you take outside advertising, the Jews are going to take over. That's the way it works. The Jews will take over. That's what happened to me at RBN. That's why I got kicked off, because I refused to stop lambasting and roasting the Jews. So they finally had enough and they kicked me off. So that's not going to happen at Eurofolk Radio. It has never happened on Talk Shoe. It has happened on Block Talk. I got kicked off of Block Talk as well because I refused to stop criticizing the Hoaxacost. But we just keep on and keep on and keep on and keep on. Yahshua said, tarry till I come. So we're going to keep on doing what we have to do until he comes. Yeah, some garlic and onions. I've been adding that to my breakfast, and that keeps people away. Right? I don't know if it's better for other people or whether it's better for me. Oh, garlic breath. Garlic breath is here. Stay away. But nevertheless, as you can tell, I'm in good spirits. Just a little bit of congestion, just a little bit of a cough left from this. Well, I got exposed to the elements. That's all it was. Moving furniture in 0-degree weather, snow, rain, ice, wet shoes. You know, when your shoes get sopping wet and you have no opportunity to dry them off on a cold day, you know, you're likely to catch a cold. So, but let's continue here. This is Parthia, part two. And this is from the book, The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel, found by Stephen Collins. And this is part two. Last week we did part one of this book. In chapter four, an account was cited that a large portion of the ten tribes who escaped Assyrian captivity by migrating northward into the Caucasus were led by a chief or prince whom they appointed. How did David's descendants come to rule in that region? This indicates that they made a clean break with whatever dynasty was ruling Israel in its last days, and that a new leader was appointed by the escaping Israelites. And this would have to be absolutely correct, because certainly Omri, there was no more King Omri, and whatever king of the ten northern tribes happened to be ruling, I think it was Hosea, was the last one before the major deportations began. Certainly, those kings were deposed, and the 12 tribes that were scattered among the Assyrians would have selected their own leaders, especially once they had reestablished their independence from the Assyrians. Okay, so, I eat cloves of my own homegrown garlic every day. You must not have any friends. But be that as it may, I'm sure that's healthy. And brush your teeth three times a day. Thank you for that advice, Celtic warrior. Okay, let's continue. Yes, the, excuse me. The Israelites would have been seeking their independence from the Assyrians at every opportunity after the deportations. And this is exactly what happened. And that's why we have the Scythians and the Sakae and the Cimmerians and others who are actually Israelites by different names. Okay, so the subsequent evidence that their rulers included the name of Pharez, P-H-R-A-E-S, Pharez, argues that this group of the ten tribes picked a prince of David's royal line as their new leader. Very good. They migrated in approximately 724 to 721 B.C., although they were taken captive. The half-tribe of Manasseh was taken captive first in 745 B.C., and transported north to Media, and several waves of Assyrian invasions took off more and more Israelite captives. They were being used in Nineveh and other Assyrian cities to as slave labor, to build monuments and things like that. And by 653 B.C., a leader of the Scythian-Cimmerian-Median alliance against Assyria was led by a person named Phraortes. The name Phraortes includes the root word Pharez, indicating a likely link to the Davidic royal line of Pharez. Phraortes is often regarded as a Mede, but his name is similar to the name of a later Parthian kings. Phraates or Phraateses. Not sure how to pronounce that one. This indicates that Phraortes was a Scythian bearing a Parthian royal name, even though Parthia would not exist for another 400 years. Of course, the independence of the Parthian, Sakae, Cimmerian, Scythian people, where they were still struggling to develop that, vis-a-vis not only the Assyrians, but the Medes and Persians as well. So it took a while yet for the name Parthia to become well known. Okay, Troublemaker says Pharez and Zerah were products of whoredom and incest. That's not true. They were, if you want to count whoredom as race mixing, that's not true, because Tamar was a Shemitic Aramaic woman, and so that was not race mixing there. And Yahweh's not concerned whether the offspring were born in wedlock or not. because the only important thing here is that they are white, that they are in fact Shemitic, Aramaic, Adamite offspring of a Shemitic Judah and a Shemitic Tamar. That's all that matters here. And obviously Yahweh is satisfied with that. So was Jacob satisfied with that. So were all the other brothers of Judah satisfied with that. And they never complained about it. So why should we? So, of course, the testament of the 12 patriarchs in the section written by Judah, he goes to great lengths to apologize, admit that he erred when he married the Canaanite woman. He states that he did so while he was drunk, but because he was actually an honorable man, he stuck to his oath, his vow, his marriage vow to his Canaanite woman, which he really should not have done. Okay, so he got drunk one night and had sex with a non-white woman. He should have left her. So, in other words, it shows he had a mixed sense of morality. He did the wrong thing and tried to do right by her. He should have just left her. Should have just left her. She was not of his race. But he was a confused young man, and obviously his actions show that. And the same thing was true of others of the 12 patriarchs. They weren't always doing the right thing. They all made a lot of mistakes. Although I agree, troublemaker, this was by far the worst. Judah, by marrying a Canaanite woman, did the same thing that Esau did. Same thing that Esau did. However, Judah repented of the fact. Esau never repented of the fact. Okay? So here we go. The name Phraortes includes the root word Pheres, which is very important here. Pheres is one of the twin sons of Tamar, a pure white woman. Phraortes is often regarded as a Mede, but his name is similar to the names of later Parthian kings. Okay, so even though Parthia would not exist yet for another 400 years, it's obvious that the name Pheres and Parthia go together. It is apparent that Davidic rulers of the line of Pheres were ruling in Scythic Iberia a century before Jehoiakim was made a vassal king of the Babylonians in approximately 563 BC. What does she mean here by Scythic Iberia? Well, as opposed to Spanish Iberia, remember the Spanish peninsula was originally called Iberia, meaning land of the Hebrews. So was Armenia at one time referred to as Iberia. This is what the author means by Scythic Iberia, as more properly called Armenian Iberia. And even today we have white Armenians living in that territory. And even some white Kurds, the Kur, were originally an offshoot of the 12 tribes of Israel, were definitely white people. If not of the 12 tribes of Israel, they're related either to the Medes or the Syrians, because all of these, and Aramaeans, all of these were originally white people, descended from either Japheth or Shem, but primarily from Shem. So they were kinsmen of the Israelites, although not necessarily Israelites. Let's continue. While David's descendants were ruling, literally, all over Asia, among the scattered descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, the reader should not assume that their reigns were all enlightened or cooperative. Well, neither were the reigns of the vast majority of the kings of Israel and or the kings of Judah. The vast majority of these kings, as the prophet Samuel told David, was that they're not going to be very good people. The vast majority of them would be evil, according to the prophecy, and they were. There were only a few good kings, even up until the day of Yahshua Messiah, the coming of the Messiah. Very, very few good kings. And even today, although we have literal descendants of King David on various thrones in the world today, very, very few of them have ever been really good kings. David was given the blessing that his seed would always be rulers over the 10 tribes of Israel. Indeed, they still are. However, David's descendants were also under a curse. After David committed adultery with Bathsheba and also arranged the death of her husband Uriah, Nathan the prophet was sent by God to deliver a curse, 2 Samuel 12:10, that the sword shall never depart from thine house. The sword symbolizes that death by violence and murder would be common among David's descendants. Indeed, it has been, all the way down to Tsar Nicholas II, who was assassinated by the Jew Bolsheviks in 1917. This happened in David's lifetime as Amnon, David's eldest son, was killed by Absalom, David's favorite son. Absalom was then killed during a rebellion against David, and another of David's sons, Adonijah, was killed by King Solomon, David's son, via Bathsheba. This curse also clung to the ruling house of Parthia. Oh, too bad for them. As we shall see in chapter 8, Parthia's Arsacids regularly fought among themselves over the throne of Parthia, and the more brutal rulers killed many of their own relatives in order to eliminate rivals to the throne. So what else is new? Israelites killing each other. Yet no matter how brutal or vicious the Arsacids were among themselves, the Parthians always insisted that their rulers had to be blood members of the Arsacid family. That's very good. Laura Ferez is telling me I should take orange juice with jalapenos or cayenne pepper. That'll do. Cayenne pepper will do. Thanks. But I'm not really as sick as I sound. It's just congestion. I'm actually feeling pretty good. So I'm pretty much over the worst of it. It's just it sounds really bad. But let's continue here, because this is really good stuff. I'm trying to open a damn page. Let me get back to it. Here we are. Okay. Another prominent city of Parthia was named Asak. A-S-A-A-K. Don't you know? Asak. And it sounds to me just like Isaac, where Arsaces was crowned king, which clearly represents a form of the name of Isaac. The name of Isaac had also been attached to geographical areas in Asia long before Parthia ever became independent. Strabo records that Alexander the Great noted a region named Asacanus, which was traversed in Alexander's expedition to India. Let me spell that for you. It's A-S-A-A-C-A-N-U-S, Asacanus. The Parthian province of Media, Atropatene, was located southwest of the Caspian Sea. The noted historian George Rawlinson records that in Parthian times, its chief city was called Gaza. This city was apparently named after the famous old Palestinian city of the same name, no doubt, arguing its inhabitants had come from Palestine. Given the fact that 2 Kings 17:6 records that the Assyrian conquerors of old Israel had transported Israelite captives to the cities of the Medes, it is not surprising that we later find a city of the Medes bearing a Palestinian name. In the Parthian province of Harkinia, located on the southeast shores of the Caspian Sea, we find that two of its chief cities were named Samariani and Karta. These names are clear evidence of the presence of Israelites from the former 10-tribe kingdom of Israel. Israel's capital city was named Samaria. Samariani. Samaria. Samariani. Samaria. No, can't be any. It's just a coincidence. Can't be any connection. And 2 Kings 17, 6-7 records that its inhabitants, after a three-year siege, were transplanted by the Assyrians into Asia after the city fell. Centuries later, we find a Parthian city, Samariani, bearing the name of the capital city of the old Kingdom of Israel. It is logical that Israelite captives would later move to a place of their choosing after the Assyrian Empire disintegrated. and name one of their new cities in honor of their ancestral capital. The city named Karta bears the same Semitic root word which represents the name Carthage, as was discussed earlier. We discussed this last week. There is additional evidence to support the Israelite origins of the Parthians. While initial Parthian coins were inscribed in Greek, later Parthian coins bear Semitic inscriptions. Now, this is interesting stuff, folks, because we know that all of the images on these coins from Parthia, from Greece, from Rome, and other related, the Medes and Persians, all of the images on these coins show white people. White people. They do not show Negroes. They do not show hook-nosed, receding forehead Jews. They show white people. Proving that all of these Parthians and all of these Israelites, all of these Medes and Persians, etc., etc., were in fact white people, all of them descended from Shem. Okay, the Parthian monarchs, whose faces are shown on their coins, clearly exhibit facial features of the white race. Let me repeat this. This is Mr. Collins speaking, not me. The Parthian monarchs, whose faces are shown on their coins, clearly exhibit facial features of the white race, not of the Jews, supporting a Shemitic origin for the Parthian nation. Whether we look, in fact, they were Aryans. Whether we look at their language, their names, or their faces, all hard evidence indicates a Shemitic, that is, Aryan origin for the Parthians, debunking speculation that the Parthians were a Mongoloid race or even a Jewish race. I mean, if you want to go Mongoloid, talk Jews. From the interior of Asia. During Jesus Christ's ministry, Matthew 10:6 states that he sent his 12 apostles to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Biblical references to the house of Israel identify the 10 tribes of Israel, not the Jews, who were not called the house of Judah either, because the Jews are not, they're neither Judah nor Israel. Since Jesus Christ commissioned his apostles to go to the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, it is clear that Jesus knew that the Israelites could be found in specific homelands at that time. Also, the apostles expressed no surprise at this commission, as not one of them said, "No one knows where the 10 tribes are. They were long ago lost." No, they said no such thing, folks. Yet the Jews claim that the 10 tribes are lost and disappeared forever. Josephus and Jesus Christ did not consider the 10 tribes to be lost at all. But of course, the word lost, translated from the Greek, means apolumi, meaning put away in punishment. Doesn't mean disappeared. It means put away in punishment. So they knew, everybody knew, that only the Israelites were put away in punishment by Yahweh. No other people could possibly have been put away in punishment by Yahweh. So therefore, you have to know what the word lost really means. It does not mean they got lost and couldn't find their way back. It means no such thing. It means they were exiled, and they knew they were exiles. It's really important that you know the real definitions of words in the Greek and in the Hebrew. It is significant that the Apostle Peter wrote the book of 1 Peter from the city of Babylon. And this comes from 1 Peter 5:13. Since Babylon was a city of the Parthian Empire at that time, it indicates that Peter had heeded Jesus Christ's instructions by traveling to territory ruled by the 10 tribes. Historical accounts also assert that the Apostle Thomas traveled within Parthia. Indeed, the early church historian Eusebius identified Thomas as the apostle sent to the Parthians. There are historical records which link the Apostle Thomas to the Parthian king Gondopheres, as in Pharez, son of Judah, who reigned in ancient India. Remember, Abraham sent Keturah's six sons east so they would not interfere with the covenant relationship between Yahweh and Isaac. The covenants were to pass through Isaac and then through Jacob. This is why Yahweh had Abraham send the sons of Keturah east. And where'd they go? Well, they went to what's called Arabia and India. So the Parthians would have found relatives, Abrahamites, namely the Indo-Aryans. They would have found that the Indo-Aryans were, in fact, their relatives, the Indo-Aryans being the direct descendants of Abraham and Keturah. That's why they called their priests were called Brahmins, short for Abraham Brahmins. And the god they worshipped was called Brahman, also named after Abraham. These were the descendants of Abraham and Keturah living in India. Let's continue. The presence of the apostles of Jesus Christ in Parthian territory shows their recognition that the Parthians were Israelites. Now, do you understand why the history of Parthia has been totally covered up by the Jews? So you would not know that the so-called lost tribes or exiled tribes were in this territory all along? You're not supposed to know this. Shh, don't tell anybody. You're not supposed to know this. It is also significant that there were Parthian believers in the God of Israel who made pilgrimages to Jerusalem for the annual holy days of God. Acts 2, 1 through 10 states that Parthians were present at the Pentecost day when the Holy Spirit was poured out to the apostles. The Medes, Elamites, and dwellers in Mesopotamia mentioned in Acts 2, 9 had all come from Parthian provinces. Since part of the 10 tribes had been settled in Media, it is likely that the Medes who made a religious pilgrimage to Jerusalem were Israelites from the 10 tribes. Some of these pilgrims were certainly Judahites, not Jews, Judahites living in Parthia. But many were not Judahites. Verse 10 indicates that these pilgrims were Judahites and proselytes, that is, of the other 11 tribes. Since Israelites from the 10 tribes were non-Judahites, the term proselytes could apply to them as well as to non-Israelites. The holy day, which the apostles and devout pilgrims were keeping, later called Pentecost, was the Feast of Weeks from Leviticus 23, verses 15 through 21. And, of course, this whole episode of the first Pentecost fulfills the prophecy made by Abraham that the Israelites would possess the territory all the way from the Nile River to the Tigris and Euphrates. The Israelites were in possession of all that territory at the time of Christ. So that prophecy was fulfilled in the days of Yahshua, the Jews. Under no circumstances will ever fulfill any of this. In the preceding chapter, it was shown that the old Phoenician Hebrew trait of wearing a pointed hat was continued in the Scythian tribes. Parthian coins show that the wearing of a pointed hat or mitre was also a custom of the Parthian kings. One more item of evidence concerning the Israelite nature of the Parthian Empire will be presented, and then chapter 8 will examine its fascinating, albeit obscure, history. The final piece of evidence concerns the name Parthia itself. In chapter 3, it was pointed out that the Hebrew word for covenant, BRT or BRTH, brith, was commonly used wherever the Empire of Israel was dominant. This Hebrew word formed the basis for regions colonized by Israel, Britain and Brittany, or for migrating groups of Israelites, the Brythonic Celts. We have seen that the Phoenician Hebrew Empire and Carthage placed the Hebrew word brith on their coins. How does this all pertain to the Parthians? Well, this BRT, Berith means house. It means house. It means house of Israel. That's what BRT means. Or in this case, house of Judah or house of Phares. In the ancient world, the letters B and P were interchangeable. Both are phonetic labial sounds. In this book, in his book, Phoenician Origin of Britain, Scots, and Anglo-Saxons, L.A. Waddell points out that the Phoenicians interchanged the B's and P's in various forms of the word BRT. He lists many ancient forms in which the root word BRT was expressed. Words such as Barat, Prat, Britannia, Piritord are just a few examples of words based on the Hebrew word for covenant. The ancient British chronicles record that the first king of Britain was named Brutus, whose name was also formed by the BRT, consonants of the Hebrew word for covenant. Covenant man, British, means covenant man. Waddell notes that the Phoenicians interchanged the B's and P's in the Mediterranean world. It adds that the Phoenicians of Cilicia called the city of Tarsus Parthenia. And that's, of course, where Paul came from, because Paul himself tells us he is an Israelite of the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, so, hold on. Lost my place here. Back to the word covenant. So we have all this evidence that this BRT, Brith or Berith, is an Israelite word, is a Hebrew word, and it maintains its popularity with the Parthians and other tribes of Israelites, the Scythians, the Cimmerians, and others. Then he says, the identity of the Parthians is no longer a mystery. They were the covenant people of the 10 tribes of Israel who were then living in Asia. Their very name declared to the world that they were the covenant people. Indeed, an early king of their Scythian kinsmen named Partatua, circa 626 BC, included the PRT root word which foreshadowed the later name Parthia. Now I have to interject here. Stephen Collins is the author of this book about Parthia, so you could just search for his name, Stephen Collins / Parthia, or simply Stephen Collins Parthia in your browser, and this will come up. I'm reading from the KeithHunt.com/parth2.html. And it includes all this information about the linguistic Hebrew origin of the word Parthia, and it's being related not only to the word Phares, but also to the word Berith, the Hebrew word Berith, meaning covenant people. Let me just point out here that it goes without saying that the Judahites were also taken captivity and placed among these 10 tribes. Otherwise, they would not have had Phares leaders. They would not have had leaders of the house of Phares. We also know that it was King Sennacherib, the very last invading Assyrian king, who took many cities of Judah and Benjamin, took them captive, and placed them among the other 10 tribes who were already there in Armenia and in Assyria. This is where the 10 tribes got their leaders from this last influx of captives, namely from the house of Judah. That's where they came from. Let's continue. The interchangeability of the P's and B's in the ancient world has also been noted by a modern epigrapher, Dr. Barry Fell. He gives the name Pea Celts to a group of Celts who used P and B interchangeably. These Pea Celts were the Brythonic Celts, and they gave birth to the Breton, Welsh, and Cornish languages, as well as the ancient Gaulish languages of Central and Eastern Europe. Here again, this is common knowledge among those of us in identity, namely that the Celtic people, the Welsh people, and the Cornish people, and the Irish, and all of those known as British and English and Scottish and Welsh, are in fact Israelites. They are the Celtic Israelites who came to Britain well before, in some cases over 1,000 years before, the Anglo-Saxon migration overland. These Celtic Israelites migrated primarily by sea. The first wave came from Zara Judah during the Egyptian captivity of Israel. Zara Judah and his tribe and others, including Danites and probably many of other tribes as well, who didn't want to be slaves in Egypt, got in ships and escaped across the Mediterranean, where they founded Troy and Rome, and they founded Iberia, namely Spain, and indeed Ireland, whose nickname is the flag they have of the red twine wrapped around the wrist, the Prince of the Scarlet Thread, comes directly from Zara Judah, right out of Genesis, where the woman who was helping Tamar give birth tied a red string around the wrist of Zara Judah because she thought he was going to be born first. But then he pulled his hand in and Pharaoh's was born first. So that's why Zara is known as the Prince of the Scarlet Thread. That Genesis verse is recorded in the flag of the Red Hand of Ulster. Those of us who know our true history understand these things. Next heading, Israelites, the covenant people. The Bible records that the tribes of Israel under Moses made a covenant with God. The Israelites retained the unique awareness that they were the covenant people as an enduring part of their culture. The Hebrew word for covenant is berith, and it was placed upon people, places, and Phoenician Carthaginian coins. The presence of the Hebrew word for covenant on ancient peoples or places is a strong identifier for locating where the 10 tribes of Israel migrated after leaving Palestine. Amen to that. That's only logical. No other people on the planet ever. Let me repeat. No other people on the planet ever referred to themselves as the covenant people. It was only much later when the Jews, pretending to be Israel, adopted that name. And they have what's called B'nai B'rith, that is the children of the devil, sons of the devil, sons of the covenant. Listed below are important examples. The Hebrew word for covenant without vowels is B-R-T or B-R-T-H. With vowels, B'rith, B'rat, B'rith, B'rit, B'rith, etc. Tribal place names associated with migrating Israelites, Britain, Breton, Brittany, Brythonic Celts, etc. Some ancient cultures interchanged the letters P and B. The Brythonic Celts who settled in ancient Britain were known as P Celts because of this trait. The ancient Greeks also manifested this trait using the term Prytanic Islands, P-R-E-T-A-N-I-C, Prytanic Islands, for Britannic Islands. Since the term Parthia has also come to us from early Greek writers, substituting a B for the initial P of this word results in Barthia or Brythia, a clear proclamation by the Parthians that they were descended from the covenant people of the 10 tribes of Israel. And he gives a couple of words, Hebrew, English versus Greek. So then, these people migrated northward and eastward into Asia, as well as westward by sea at this point in time. the overland migration westward was also taking place, but those people came to be known as Goths and Anglo-Saxons. We'll get to that later. The Sacae-Scythians and the Parthians and the Iberians. The arrival of the Picts in Britain represented another infusion of Israelite people into a population which was already largely a product of Israelite colonization. All of your Celtic migration, starting with Zara Judah in 1500 BC, and of course the tribe of Dan and the tribe of Gad and others, Asher, into the British Isles, including Ireland and also the Spanish Peninsula and Brittany on the western coast of Europe. These are all your Celtic Israelites. They were the first ones to migrate west, and they went to the Isles, just as the prophet Isaiah predicted they would. So these are all variations of Hebrew words with the word for covenant, BRT. In conclusion, let us briefly review the overwhelming evidence that the Parthians were Israelites of the 10 tribes of Israel, and I would stress that they were Parthians of all 12 tribes, not just the 10 tribes. They wouldn't be named after Perez if they weren't named after that branch of the house of Judah. The Parthians were never recorded as being in Asia until after the 10 tribes of Israel relocated to Asia, that is Asia Minor. The Bible records that these tribes were placed in the cities of the Medes, and Parthia's homeland adjoined the territory of the Medes. History records the Parthians were first under the dominion of the Assyrians, and that was also the fate of those Israelites taken captive by the Assyrians. Just another coincidence, folks. We can see the names of sub-tribes of Ephraim in the Parthian or the Parthian homelands, and history is clear that the Parthians were the kinsmen of the Scythian Saka, showing that the Parthians were also known as descendants of Isaac. And of course, we Anglo-Saxons today are exactly those descendants. The Parthians and Scythians are the people written about by Josephus as the extremely numerous descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. Josephus, who lived in the 1st century AD, wrote the following about the 10 tribes of Israel. I have to thank Mr. Collins here for not saying Josephus, the Jewish historian, because just about every time you read the name of Josephus, the author says, Josephus, the Jewish historian. He was not a Jew. He was a Judahite. And he, of course, stated, the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates till now and are an immense multitude, not to be estimated by numbers. And, of course, they were in the millions. Tens of millions of Israelites in Parthia and in Greece, and in Rome, and in Spain, and in Brittany, Gaul, and in the British Isles. Tens of millions of Israelites. We're talking 700 years later, by the time of Christ. The Israelites were all over the place, but many of them didn't know they were Israelites. Paul had to instruct them that they were, in fact, Israelites, and so did the other apostles. At the time that Josephus wrote, the Euphrates River had long been the recognized border between the Roman and Parthian empires. For Josephus to write from his perspective within the Roman Empire that the 10 tribes were beyond the Euphrates River was another way of saying that the 10 tribes were in Parthia. Even as many Americans would recognize the phrase beyond the Rio Grande as a euphemism for in Mexico or beyond the Mississippi for a cowboy. Or a cowgirl, at least if you go south to Oklahoma and Texas. But even in Kansas, even Kansas and Iowa, you have, and Montana, they got cowboys up there too. The Parthian cities of Asak, Dara, and Samariani were given Hebrew names. Thank you very much, Mr. Collins. Many groups from the Parthian Empire were among the worshippers of the God of Israel, who is named Yahweh. Not God, but Yahweh. who were in Jerusalem for a holy day of God, the first Pentecost. Well, it was Feast of Weeks, the first Feast of Weeks after the crucifixion. The Parthians had Hebrew Semitic words in their language and placed Semitic inscriptions on their coins. The Parthian Arsacid dynasty included the name of Isaac, and many individual kings had names which included the term Pharez, son of Judah and Tamar, fulfilling God's promise to David that his descendants would continue to have rulers over the house of Israel, which we still have today, folks, even though they might not be very nice people. The very name Parthia preserves the Hebrew word brith and the B shown as P, proclaiming that they were the covenant people. The facts are clear. The Parthian Empire was an empire of Israelites who, having thrown off the dominion of their captors, were now ruling over their previous masters, or at least independent countries, without interference from the outside. While Rome dominated the Mediterranean region and much of Europe, the Parthian Empire dominated the territory from the Euphrates and Indus rivers. Again, why so far east? Why India? As I explained earlier, Abraham sent his sons, the six sons he had via Keturah, east. That's where they went. They became known as the Indo-Aryans. They weren't hook-nosed kikes. They were Adamites, as all Shemites are in fact Adamites, not hook-nosed kikes. So, from the Euphrates and Indus rivers, and between the Persian Gulf to the Russian steppes of the Scythian tribes, it's a huge area controlled by Israel and related people. The Parthian Empire stretched approximately 1,900 miles from east to west and 1,000 miles from north to south. It's almost as big as New Jersey. Parthia and Rome interacted on equal terms, yet few in the modern world have ever heard about Parthia. Why? Why? Because the Jews don't want you to know. Rome and Parthia had major wars, the result of Roman aggression, major summit conferences, and even a period of détente. And of course, that period of détente, or peace treaty, was in place for the entire episode of Our Messiah. Had that not been the case, there would not have been enough peace in Jerusalem for all of those events to take place. Yahweh arranged for that peace, for that peace treaty, so that all was not chaos. And he therefore arranged for Pontius Pilate to declare him innocent. Even the Romans declared him innocent. Now here is the understanding, which we went over last month with regard to the Star of Bethlehem and the pagan origins of Christmas, that the Magi were in fact Parthians, Israelite of Parthia, and the Romans were Israelites of Rome. And the only people in that whole scenario that weren't Israelites were the Jews, the Canaanites, the Pharisees, and the Herodians, the Edomite Jews. They're the only ones who weren't Israelites. Everybody else were Israelites. White, Adamic, Shemitic, Hebrew Israelites, not Jews. You have to know the meanings of words. A Jew is one who pretends to be a Judahite. A Jew is one who pretends to be an Israelite. They're not the same. One's an imposter. So we had these major wars, and the interesting thing is that Rome was never able to defeat Parthia. Never. Parthia was just as big and powerful, possibly even more so, than Rome. Given this fact, it's absolutely incredible that nobody has ever heard of Parthia. Cover up anybody? Jewish disinformation? That's what we're dealing with here. Parthia was a monarchy with the beginnings of a bicameral government and its own independence state. In other words, it had kind of a British-style monarchy with parliament. It offered home rule to many of its cities and ruled its subjects in far better benevolent manner than did Rome. The rarely discussed but true story of this ancient Israelite empire will now be revealed in chapter 8. So that concludes chapter 7. And this is really a great book. I'm glad that it's available online. And again, this is from Keith Hunt. And the next chapter is entitled The Parthian Empire, Superpower Number 1. But before we go there, let me see if I can find, because last week I made reference to the Scythian / Parthian archers who held the Greeks at bay. And also the Romans at bay. Scythian archers. Invading hordes. Wait a minute. We're not hordes. We're civilized people. We're not barbarians. Of course, the Romans referred to the Gauls and Israelites as barbarians. That's simply a term they had for a non-Roman. Okay. And so here, the Stoa Consortium. Let's see what they have to say. Scythian archers. In Athens, the so-called Scythian archers, who may or may not have been from Scythia and who may or may not have been archers, served as a police force, keeping order in public gatherings, the council, the assembly, and the agora. And perhaps, agora, I think, is the town square, the town market. And perhaps authorized to use force against citizens under certain circumstances. In Athens, the so-called Scythian archers served as a police force. They were public slaves who served as guards or watchmen in the cities. It's quite likely that they were, in fact, Scythians. The Suda, a historical encyclopedia from the 10th century CE, that is AD, has this to say about the word archers in the context of classical Athens. Archers, the public slaves, guards of the city, in number 1,000 who formerly lived in the Agora, camping out in the middle, but later moved to the Areopagus. These were called Scythians and Spoisinoi, from a certain Spoisinos, one of the ancient politicians who organized their affairs. I would suggest that these so-called Scythian archers were in fact Israelites who had formerly made war against both the Greeks and Romans. The arrow shooting of ancient Greek practice and tactics. Let's see what this website has to offer. The issue of ancient Greek archery looms in mist as it passed to history as a distrusted weapon, alien to the codes of honorable battle, really. Though it had been kept in high respect, there was a full tactical and technical doctrine, as both literary and representational sources inform us. The Greek archery has three distinct periods: the Bronze Age, the Archaic Classical, from the 7th to the late 5th, and the Hellenistic, till the Roman conquest. So it's interesting. I wonder if these historians here actually mentioned the Parthians. But here again, you can see the Scythian asymmetric bows shown for heroes, as is Hercules, who is just another representation of Samson, and etc., etc. He wears a lion skin and uses a club or mace. He is almost always on foot. Image may be copyrighted. Again, as I said, he is the Hercules, as he's more commonly known. Is nothing but a version of Samson the Israelite. So even Greek culture, Roman culture, Parthian culture, etc., etc., all of these are directly descended from the Israelites. In the Iliad, the bow is carried either hung from the shoulder, straight or diagonally. It may be carried in a holster as panderos, but this is separate from the quiver, in stark difference with the Scythian goritos, which is a later invention. So in other words, a kind of holster or sheath for the bow. Lots of representations here of Greek/Scythian archers. Again, the connection between the Scythians and the Greeks is very great, since both the Greeks and the Scythians and the Cimmerians and the Romans all descended from various migrations of Israelites. You would expect these similarities in culture. And indeed we do. But of course, since the vast majority of people have no clue that the Parthians even existed and that the Greeks and Romans are actually descended from the Israelites, they're looking at Scythian Israelites when they think that they're not even related to Israel, and indeed they are. It's interesting, we'd have to check on the battle axe, because the battle axe was the favorite weapon of the Israelites. And let's trace the battle axe from Israel to Greece, see what happens here. Interesting. Maccabees, Antiochus III the Great. Israelite fighters rushed to Greece to help battle. Oh, that's more modern. Okay. All right. Unfortunately, I'm getting more modern stuff from the Israelis, not from... But here, let's see what the Maccabees, the Free Encyclopedia, has to say about the Maccabees. The Maccabees were the leaders of a Judahite rebel army that took control of Judah, which at the time had been a province of the Seleucid Empire. And of course, this was Greeks. They founded the Hasmonean dynasty, which ruled from 164 BC to 63 AD. They reasserted the Judahite religion, partly by forced conversion. No, only Hyrcanus did that. See, here again, you get disinformation. This is, of course, Wikipedia under Maccabees. This is disinfo. Only John Hyrcanus did this. All the other Maccabee leaders and the Hasmonean dynastic leaders reserved circumcision exclusively for Israelites. And they would not share their religion or force anybody to be converted. This is a blatant lie. And so this is what you're going to get from Jewish sources, which Wikipedia is. Let's see what else they have to say. We have about a minute and a half. In the 2nd century BC, Judea lay between the Ptolemaic kingdom based in Egypt and the Seleucid Empire based in Syria. Kingdoms formed after the death of Alexander the Great. Judea had been under Ptolemaic rule, but fell to the Seleucids around 200 BC. Judea at that time had been affected by the Hellenization begun by Alexander. Some Judahites, mainly those of the urban upper class, notably the Tobiad family, wished to dispense with Mosaic law and to adopt a Greek lifestyle. According to the historian Victor Cherikover, the main motive of the Tobiads, Hellenism, was economic and political. Of course it was. The Hellenizing Judahites built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, competed in international Greek games, removed their marks of circumcision, and repudiated the Holy Covenant. I don't know how you remove the marks of circumcision. That would be hard to do, I would think. But nevertheless, again, you cannot trust Wikipedia. They're Judaizers. And they make no distinction between... they're not going to tell you about Parthia and the Greeks. I'll find it next time. Next time, because it's such a fascinating part of history, how the Scythian/Parthian archers held the Greeks and Romans at bay. It's a very interesting story. So we're just about out of time. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh, pass the ammunition. Glad I could... do the show today, and I'll be around tomorrow, Restoration Hour and One-to-One. Probably David James and I will do another episode on the Book of Revelation. So thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh, pass the ammunition. Take care. Yahweh bless. Good night.
Call recording has been completed.